Much for invitation, and a special thank to Luis for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. So in this talk, I want to say something about geometrical inequalities or black holes. So let me first begin to describe what a geometrical inequality is in pure mathematics. And I think this is best illustrated with an example, and probably the old and most famous example of a geometrical inequality is the so-called isoperimetric inequality. So if you take a closed curve, this blue line, on a plane, and denote by L the length of the curve, and by A the area enclosed by this curve, then you have the following inequality. Very good. Wow. Very good. Then you have the following inequality. The square of the length is always greater or equal than 4 pi the area. Moreover, the quality satisfied holds only if the curve is a circle. This type of geometrical inequality in which two geometric concepts are related by an inequality will have the same form in general relativity and especially for black holes. And for me, the two main ingredients of these inequalities are the following. First of all, the inequality applies to complicated objects, that means curve of arbitrary shape. But the quality is achieved if and only if this object has sort of an optimal shape, in this case, the circle. Moreover, this optimal shape curve can be described by few parameters. And this optimal shape also has a variational characterization. In this case, it's the obvious one. That means if you fix the length, the curve that encloses the biggest area is a circle. These two aspects of the geometrical inequality will be preserved in black holes in general relativity. So, of course, general relativity is a geometric theory, so there is no surprise that this type of inequality appears in the theorem. But what is more important is that general relativity is a physical theory, and what happens is that the expected behavior of the gravitational fields and matter fields, or if you wish, the physical intuition, provides inequalities which are highly non-trivial from the mathematical point of view. And for me, this interplay between physics and geometry is what gives the geometrical inequality in general relativity their distinguished character. So somehow, respecting this interplay, the plan of the talk is the following. First, I will present you the physical picture, that means the physical motivation of the black hole inequalities, why you expect them to hold. Then I will present some results, theorems, that prove that these inequalities, with some assumptions, they are true. And finally, I want to describe the open problems, and in particular some recent results on inequalities, not in black holes, but on general bodies. So let me begin with the physical picture. So probably the best and most important known geometrical inequality in general relativity is the positive mass theorem. So the positive mass theorem says that if you have an initial data that describes an isolated system, which is complete and satisfies the local energy condition, then the eddying mass of this initial condition should be always positive, and moreover, is zero if and only if is Minkowski. So I put the inequality in the same form as the isoperimetric inequality. So the inequality holds for complicated initial data, for complicated space-time, but the quality is only achieved for an optimal shape, which is Minkowski. I mean, if you track a little bit the history of the positive mass theorem, so the mass, how the mass appears, it appears as a boundary integral in the Hamiltonian formulation. I mean, looking to this formula without the physical background will be impossible for any mathematician even to conjecture that this quantity is positive definite. In fact, to prove that not only that it's positive definite, but that it's a geometrical object that not depends on the coordinates is quite tricky. And the proof, the final proof, which was done by Schoen and Yao, and later on by Witten, Usen, Spinner, a different method, was really subtle, huh? And important. A key assumption, of course, in the positive mass theorem is that you have to assume that the energy condition holds locally. If you have an object, a macroscopic object, I don't know, like this glass, it's described by some parameters, but everything is complicated. It's difficult to find in a macroscopic object some easy inequalities that relate the parameter of the object. And of course, one exception will be the black holes, because black holes are macroscopic, but they're still simple. They are built out of pure geometry. And then if you want to try to find sort of geometrical and simple inequalities, black holes are the natural candidates. And this is what I'm going to do. So let's begin with stationary black holes. Well, in four dimensions, and I will restrict myself to four dimensions, I will make some comment at the end of the talk about higher dimension. But in this talk, I will restrict everything to four dimensions and vacuum. Everything that I'm going to say can be generalized to include electric charge, but for simplicity, let's do vacuum. So there is a well-known result, a very important one, that tells you that stationary black holes in vacuum is essentially the Kerr black hole. I mean, there are still important open issues there, technical but important, and for people who are interested in this uniqueness result, there is a nice living review on that by Kruschel, Lopez Costas, and Häusler. But everybody expects that the stationary black hole is described by Kerr. The Kerr metric depends on two parameters, mass and angular momentum. The Kerr metric as a solution of Einstein equation is, of course, well defined for any of the parameters, but it only describes a black hole if this inequality holds, this very well-known inequality, holds between the parameters. Usually people write the Kerr metric in terms of m and a, which is angular momentum per mass units, and this inequality is like a smaller or equal than m. But here I prefer to use the physical angular momentum. Okay? So if you, and the quality here is achieved in the borderline for extreme black hole. If you do sort of a naive picture of the situation in four dimensions again, so each point here in this two-dimensional diagram is a Kerr solution with parameter m and j. This boundary, this line, this blue line, is the m equal square root of j. So this extreme black hole divide the region between black holes and naked singularity. And that's why extreme black holes are so delicate and maybe so important. In this talk, they will play an important role. They will really play the role of the optimal shape, the role of the circle in the isoperimetric inequality. Yeah? So if you want to let's say, to understand cosmic censorship, of course, extreme black holes are important because everything you do here, you are really on the border on the naked singularity side. This picture is not true in higher dimension. No? Now, take the Kerr black hole and write down explicitly the area. Again, this is the explicit formula for the area of the horizon, very well known. This is a very simple formula, but extremely important. Remember that the first law of thermodynamics is here. From this equality, you deduce, trivially, the following three inequalities. This one, I wrote it again. You see that you need this inequality to write down this formula. And if you want, the main message of my talk and all the results that I will present is that these three inequalities, which are trivial consequences of this explicit formula in the stationary regime, are also valid in the dynamical regime. This will be the main message of the talk, okay? So now let me first try to, of course, this is well known because we are we have the explicit form of Kerr, but nevertheless, let me remind you the physical interpretation of these three inequalities for Kerr, for the Kerr metric. The first one, which will lead to the Penrose inequality, can be interpreted in the following form. The difference between the mass and the square root of the area is the rotational energy of the black hole. So this is the maximum amount of energy that you can extract from the Kerr black hole by a Penrose process. So you have to extract energy, extracting angular momentum. The second one can be interpreted, roughly speaking, as saying if something is going to collapse, cannot spin too fast. And you can make an argument, an heuristic argument, saying that, well, at the horizon, the gravitational energy or the gravitational force should be bigger than the rotational energy. And you get sort of this kind of inequality. The last one, I will interpret in the following form. Write the temperature, the surface density of the Kerr black hole in terms of J and area. Usually you write it in terms of J and mass, but here write it in terms of J and area. This inequality is the responsible of that this quantity is always positive definite. And moreover, that the quality is give you a zero here is achieved only if and only if the black hole is extreme. You see that there is an important difference. This inequality give you a quality for Schwarzschild. These two one give you a quality for extreme Kerr. And in fact, my talk will be concentrate more on these two inequalities. Okay, so this is sort of trivial consequence, well-known trivial consequence of the formula, the Kerr formula. But of course, black holes are in general not stationary. Many important astrophysical phenomena involve highly dynamical black holes, like black hole collision, black hole formation, or even black hole with accretion disk and matter and so on. A dynamical black hole is not a simple object. A dynamical black hole cannot be described by a few parameters. So you have black hole which is dynamical, that means that you have a gravitational field outside, and this space-time has all the complexity of the gravitational field. That means you cannot describe a few parameters. Okay? But remarkably enough, this inequality extends to the fully non-dynamical dynamical regime under some appropriate assumption I will tell you in a moment. Moreover, these inequalities are deeply connected with the cosmic censorship conjecture, and I will explain in a moment what I mean by that. So let me try to give you argument why these three inequalities extend to the dynamical regime in which you have a strong gravitational field and also very dynamic. So I will begin with this one. Usually I used to begin with this one, which is very well known, but now, because I know that this is true, I will show you why it's more convenient to begin with this one. So I want to give you some heuristic argument why you expect an inequality of this form hold in a dynamical black hole. Of course, when you have a dynamical black hole, the first issue you have is how to define the parameters. So the area of the horizon is well defined. This is okay. You can think always the area of apparent horizon or trapped surface. But the angular momentum or the mass of the black hole is very difficult. Why? Because in the stationary black hole, the eddy and mass, which is the asymptotic mass, is essentially the mass of the space-time, but also the proper mass of the black hole because there is nothing in between. If you have a gravitational field outside, then you would like to distinguish between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the energy of the gravitational field. That means the eddy mass is a global quantity which measures the mass of the whole space-time, and you would like to have quasi-local quantities, that means a mass of the black hole and not of the whole space-time. So you have three kind of quantity: global, depends on the whole space-time; quasi-local, depends on the boundary region; and local, that fields, tensor fields, depend on a point and a neighborhood. So the area is a quasi-local quantity, trivial one. But to define quasi-local mass and even quasi-local angular momentum is difficult. This problem has a long history, and for people interested, there is a very nice review by Laszlo Sabados, and there are new results by Yao and Wang, in which they provide a new and interesting new definition of quasi-local mass. But in general, I must say that these definitions are very involved, and that's all. Angular momentum is so difficult to define as it's like mass. However, angular momentum, there is a particular situation in axial symmetry in which you have a well-defined notion of angular momentum is the Comar integral. You have the Killing vector field, and you take an integral on any closed surface, and then you have a well-defined notion of quasi-local angular momentum. Moreover, this is conserved in a precise sense. Physically, that means that axially symmetric gravitational waves do not carry angular momentum. And this is the big simplification in the dynamics in axial symmetry. So you still allow for strong fields, you still allow for very dynamical fields, but you restrict yourself for fields that cannot move angular momentum. So vacuum, axially symmetric waves cannot move angular momentum. But that means that in axial symmetry, you have two well-defined quasi-local quantities, area and angular momentum. What about mass? Well, you can say, let's take the Kerr formula and define this quantity just plugging area and J of the dynamical black hole. This is nothing but, of course, the same formula that I showed you before. This one. The only thing is that I put J and M from the, for a dynamical black hole, and then I define just this quantity. But then you can ask, well, this is just a definition, of course. If this quantity has anything to do with the mass, the quasi-local mass of the black hole, and let me argue about that. And the argument is the following. Now you have a dynamical black hole here with some area and some quasi-local mass, and then you have your initial data or your initial conditions, and then you let it evolve. What is going to happen? Well, what you expect is that the area should increase because Hawking area theorem. What about the mass of the black hole? Is it going to increase? Well, no, in general not, because with the Penrose process, you can extract energy from the black hole to outside, to the other region. But in axial symmetry, there is no Penrose process. So there is no known mechanism in axial symmetry to extract energy from the black hole. That means that you expect that whatever definition of mass you have, the quasi-local mass and the area should always increase with time. This is sort of a heuristic argument, okay? But this is true, and we have our definition. Just take a time derivative of this thing, which I just put. This is sort of writing down the first law of thermodynamics, but let me emphasize that this equation here is just a trivial consequence of this explicit formula. So you take a derivative of that. And in our case, angular momentum is conserved. That means that the variation of the mass is proportional to the variation of the area times the temperature. This is what you know. But the temperature is defined like this quantity, again, for a dynamical black hole. And this quantity will be positive, and this is the thing you would like to have, because then when the area increases, the mass will also increase, will be positive if and only if this inequality holds in the dynamical regime. And this is what I'm going to prove. But you see here that, of course, this is sort of a weak argument, in the sense that I knew this argument for many years. But let's say you find a counterexample to this in the dynamical regime. What is it going to tell you? Well, it's going to tell you that this definition of mass is not the right one, and that's all. On the other hand, if you prove that, and that's what I'm going to tell you, tells you that first, this is a good definition of mass, and second, that you have an extra monotonic quantity in the axially symmetric evolutions. Monotonic quantities are always very important to control the size of the evolution. Okay? So yes,
but
it's true.
The point is that you want that function to reduce to the Kerr expression.
Exactly. And, of course, if you give me some monotonic function to the area, what I want to prove is this one, and it's sharp what I want to prove. I even prove rigidity here, you will say in a moment. So there is not much. So now let's go to the Penrose inequality. So I give you some argument for this one. So let's provide argument for this too. And this is something. So many years ago, Penrose provided a very, I will say, deep and important physical argument, which led to this so-called Penrose inequality, not in axial symmetry, but in general. And the argument is important because it connects global properties of the space-time, cosmic censorship in particular, with quantities that you can compute under initial conditions. And in the initial conditions, you are able to prove things. I mean, to prove things for the whole evolution is extremely difficult, okay? But let me present you roughly the Penrose argument, but with the two new ingredients. First is a restriction I will impose that I have axial symmetry, and then the angular momentum is conserved. And the second one is the real new ingredient is that I know, because I'm going to prove it, that this inequality holds. So let me reproduce Penrose's argument with these two new ingredients. So what Penrose says is, let's assume that the standard picture of the gravitational collapse holds. That means that you have a data is going to collapse, is going to produce a black hole, and moreover, you expect that the system will relax to a final stationary regime, will emit all the gravitational waves, and then will be stationary. And because there is uniqueness, you expect this final black hole to be Kerr black hole. These are the assumptions. This is, of course, are, if you want, the most important open problem in classical GR, to prove that really this is what happens, that all the singularities are inside black holes, and even that the system settled down to the stationary final regime. Let us denote by M0, A0, and G0 the parameter of these final black holes. So you have a dynamical black hole here, then you wait a lot of time, and then you reach, in the future, a final black hole which is stationary, and all the radiation goes away. So in a Penrose diagram, what you have is the following. Let's say you have a Cauchy surface here, your initial data, and let's assume that the initial data in this Cauchy surface, the collapse has already occurred. That means that you see an apparent horizon on the surface. Okay? This horizon will have area A. Well, of course, there is a tricky distinction between event and apparent horizon. I don't want to go into this detail, but if you want, you can ask me. So this area is the intersection of the event horizon with the slice, for simplicity, I would say. Now the black hole evolved and reached this final black hole with parameter J0, M0, N0. And here you have the angular momentum of your initial condition, J and M, which is always well defined. It's a dA, dM, J and M. Now you ask, which is the relation of the final parameter of the black hole with the initial ones? Well, the area you know, the area of the black hole, the final, should be bigger than the initial ones, Hawking area theorem. The relation between the mass you also know, because this is the total mass of the space-time, this is the mass only of the final black holes, the difference are the gravitational waves, and this carry positive energy. So the mass always satisfies this condition. This you know. What about the angular momentum? Well, in general, there is no simpler relation whatsoever between the final angular momentum of the black hole and the total angular momentum of the space-time. You can have total angular momentum equal to zero, but you have a black hole with non-zero angular momentum and vice versa, because, I mean, the surrounding of the black hole is also spinning. But in axial symmetry, angular momentum is strictly conserved. So this is the new ingredient. Moreover, because you know that this inequality is satisfied, this quantity is monotonically increasing. That means if you compute this quantity at the initial condition, then you have this, because remember, this quantity gives you the mass for Kerr. So you have this inequality. And because you have this inequality, you relate two quantities that can be computed on the initial condition, this one and this one. And what you get is, now this is a very, I like this argument because before was very, it's tricky to deduce this inequality. And you get the following generalization of the Penrose inequality. When j equal to zero, this is a classical Penrose inequality, which holds without any symmetry assumption, where when if you want to include j, well, you have to assume axial symmetry. This inequality implies this one. I mean, this thing is always bigger than the square root of j. You can easily check that algebraically, make a derivative of the area. Moreover, this inequality can be deduced directly in the same way without using the area theorem. You just use the angular momentum is conserved and the energy is the gravitational waves carry positive energy. I mean, to make contact with the fluid thing is I mean, here you see that, I mean, for people who do in this fluid analogy. So here you are in the situation, you have a final state when you know the inequality is holds, and then the only thing you have to assume the evolution is that the mass is conserved or is decreasing and the angular momentum is conserved. Okay. Sorry?
So those assumptions,
yeah.
I think the strongest one is probably the last one, which says that cosmic censorship
Yeah. So then the class, what you say is, if you find, now you, we can compare this argument with the previous one. Here, I mean, a counterexample will be very relevant. You find a counterexample, you are saying that something is wrong with cosmic censorship, in some sense. On the other hand, if
you... It seems weaker than you actually know, so you would say we're based on the following facts and one assumption.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. So now the summary is the following. You expect from this heuristic argument that the following two inequalities hold for dynamical black holes. However, this one is still an open problem. But this one implies the following two. The first one is the classical Penrose inequality, and the second one is the inequality between mass and spin. It is important that, from the mathematical point of view, at least up to now, this divides in two groups. The first one, the area appears as the lower bound, and the second group, the charge, or the angular momentum, if you put electric charge also, appears as a lower bound. For people who know what the BPS bound is, they look more like these BPS bounds for solitons, where charge appears as a lower bound, and moreover, the equality is reached by the extreme. So this talk is more concerned with these two inequalities, and the mathematical method that I develop I'm not sure if I can apply to you to prove this one. Huh? Okay, so now results. Well, first of all, what means a result here? What means a theorem? What I mean by a theorem here? By a theorem, I mean I want to prove a mathematical consequence of Einstein equation. This is a theorem. So you assume Einstein equation holds, or part of Einstein equation holds, in particular the constraints usually, and then you want to prove a result. This is the game here, okay? The first one, which is not my main concern in this talk, but is very important, is what is known about the Penrose inequality without any symmetry? Well, there are two important papers, the first one by Whisker and Ilmanen, and shortly after by Hugh Bray, in which they prove the Penrose inequality in the Riemannian case. That means on initial condition that has zero extrinsic curvature. This Penrose inequality has a long history, and perhaps the first important achievement was this discovery by Bob Geroch about the inverse mean curvature flow. And finally, it has been proved in the Riemannian case, but the general case is open, and moreover, this inequality with angular momentum is completely open. So for people interested in that, there is this also very nice review by Mark Marx about Penrose inequality. So what about the inequality between mass and angular momentum? And this is the theorem. So the theorem says the following. You have an initial data, which is vacuum, axially symmetric, and has two asymptotically flat ends. Okay? Two asymptotically flat ends. Then, on any end, the following inequality holds. Moreover, the equality holds if and only if the data is extreme. What I mean by that? So this is the theorem. There are some extra technical assumptions, but essentially, this is the theorem. Well, this is the history of the theorem. So roughly speaking, I proved this theorem some years ago, and then there were some very nice generalizations, including charge and relaxing some technical assumptions. And there are still some many open problems there, but just I want to concentrate in the meaning of the theorem. This is the Kerr Penrose diagram for Kerr. If you take a surface here, this surface will be an initial condition for the Kerr space-time, or the globally hyperbolic domain of the Kerr space-time. And this surface will be also maximal. So the maximal condition is a technical restriction. So remember that maximal means that the trace of the second fundamental form is zero. If you take this surface here, This alpha has the geometry, exactly the same geometry as the Schwarzschild initial data. This one. So this is an initial condition with two asymptotic ends. For example, non-extreme Schwarzschild for people who know Bohn-Yor on this. Many of these kind of data have been used a lot for black hole collisions. But if you take extreme care, and you take this slice, the geometry change. You reach this point here, in which this is a very interesting point, in which the event horizon touch with the singularity, in some sense. And this, the geometry, has the form of a cylinder. What mean by a cylinder? Well, if you take the area of the two surfaces and you go to in this direction, so the area of the sphere, and you go in this direction, then the area increase, and here also. Here increase, this is the minimal surface, and here increase again. But if you go in this other direction, the area reach a limit. And this geometry is the optimal shape. This is the extreme initial data geometry, which you have one asymptotic flat end and one cylindrical. If you have an initial data that satisfies the quality here at any end, then should be extreme. Of course, I have here the extra assumption that the data has only two ends, because it's the thing that I can prove. But I will expect that the same thing happens with any number of ends as in the positive mass theorem. If you have any number of ends and at any end the equality holds, that means that everything should collapse and give you only one extreme care. So this is the first, of course, this gives you evidence, indirect evidence, that cosmic censorship maybe is true, because otherwise it's difficult to guess that this kind of inequality in the dynamical regime should hold.
Can you elaborate on that? Why do you say that?
Sorry?
Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, this we are guessing. We use cosmic censorship to guess an inequality. I know which is non-trivial. Then you prove it. Somehow we give you indirect evidence that probably is true. And in fact, I think that original Penrose wanted to find counterexamples. Huh? Of course, it's far from giving a proof of cosmic censorship. What about the second result? So again, there are many generalizations of this result. I don't want to go into the details. Just give you, and the second result is the following. This one is different from the other one, because in the other one you have the mass. That means it's a global result. You need a whole initial data. Here this is a local result. What you need, you assume that you have a closed trap surface, which will be the horizon, but it's a trap surface, which is closed and stable, and we'll show, I will tell you in a moment what the stable means, in a space-time which the dominant tendency condition is satisfied. You assume that you have axial symmetry in the neighborhood of the surface only. And then the following inequality holds. So you see that because you assume axial symmetry at the surface, then you can define the angular momentum of the two surfaces by the common integral. A is the area of the two surfaces. And then you compute and you have that this inequality should always hold in the dynamical regime. Okay? Moreover, the quality holds if only if the surface is what I call extreme throat, and I will flash you in a moment what I mean by that. It's important, for me it was surprising also that you can extend this result. You don't assume vacuum, you assume axial symmetry but non-vacuum, so the matter can infold to the black hole in an axial symmetric wave, but still can carry angular momentum. Huh? And you don't assume any maximal slicing condition. So this theorem, I will say, is optimal. The only thing that you are imposing is axial symmetry, and you are imposing it essentially because you don't know how to define angular momentum without it. It would be nice to try to see if these kind of things are valid without axial symmetry, and it would be nice to see if you have some, I don't mean a proof, but some heuristic arguments, because the heuristic argument that I present you relies on axial symmetry. I know, of course, that the other inequality is false without the symmetry. This is false, clearly. Yeah? So you have ADN mass. Let's say you have two bodies rotating like this. You can have a huge angular momentum and the mass is always bounded. So in some sense, this inequality is stronger and maybe more fundamental than the other one. So this is the history of the theorem. This theorem was proved first in the stationary case. And you can say, the stationary case is non-trivial because you don't have to, if you assume that everything is stationary, then you have Kerr. But if you assume that you have a stationary in a neighborhood of the surface, then you can have matter outside, and this can be quite complicated. So the Marcus Ansor and Pfister, and then Hennig, Ansor, and Cederbaum, they prove it for the stationary case. And then I provide this heuristic argument in the dynamical regime, and I prove it near the extreme case with a local argument. And then we finally, with Martin Rydis, we prove it in the full case. And there were many extensions. And at the end, I want to comment this one by Stefan Holland for higher dimensions. So you can include charge and everything, okay? So let me, roughly speaking, tells you what a trap surface is and what a stable means. So trap surface, you have two-dimensional surface, and then you compute the null geodesic expansion. You compute the diversion of this of the vector field, that means the expansion. I say that the surface is marginally trapped if the null expansion is zero. This is, of course, the standard concept of Penrose trap surface. Stability is a condition of the first derivative of the expansion. And essentially means that if you move a little bit from the surface, on the surface the expansion is zero, but if you move a little bit in both directions, the expansion is positive. So this is a condition on the first derivative. It's sort of a local minimum. And this is a very important condition. For example, just to show you, this surface here are all trapped and stable. This one here are all trapped but unstable. And they do not satisfy the inequality. Yeah?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah. I say that this surface here. This is an horizon, okay? These are trapped surfaces which are unstable in the sense that they do not satisfy the stability condition.
The expansion changes sign as you go across.
I don't want, sorry? What, here?
Yeah, so if you're inside, the expansion is going to be negative. If you're outside, it's going to be positive.
Yeah.
So that's
not positive. No. You want that the essentially the first derivative is positive. So my claim is that here are unstable, yeah. So I mean, and in fact, you can check that the inequality is not satisfied here. Huh? Yeah, maybe. Let's go to the definition. So this is the condition. Yes, exactly. This one should be positive, and this one can be zero. So it's moving in the k direction with a negative sign.
Okay, so if you go back to the diagram. So as you cross the event horizon, you're going from positive to zero to negative.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're moving across the other, the white hole horizon, you're going from negative.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And for the extreme case, you're going from positive to zero to positive.
This is also unstable. No. This will be marginal stable. So this will give you the zero.
Okay.
Exactly. It's amazing that I proved the theorem, and long after that, I just really check what happened here. I mean, but you calculate this surface, and you see that the area is not bigger than the J, and it, sorry, say it again?
Yeah, what is going from positive to zero to negative?
The expansion. So, but what is the rigidity here? Which is, I also like it a lot. What means equality here? Well, this is a true surface, okay? But the quality tells you that the surface should be very special. It will be exactly what? Exactly. This in the limit here, you get a two-dimensional sphere surface, which has a very precise geometry. For example, the intrinsic metric of this limit sphere is given by that. What is that? This is sort of an oblate sphere that is sort of, you can say, rotating around the axis. And the rigidity tells you that if you have a quality in your trapped surface, then this trapped surface should be this one. Should be exactly this sphere with exactly this intrinsic metric and exactly the second fundamental form of the sphere, of this sphere, which is zero. So both the intrinsic and the extrinsic geometry is fixed by the rigidity. So again, this is the way in which this optimal form appears. So for an arbitrary closed trapped surface, so the topology is always S2, but the geometry of the surface can be very complicated. The inequality holds, but the quality is only achieved in this case where you have exactly this oblate surface, like in the extreme case. Okay, so let me go to the open problems. And I want to finish also with some result on objects. Okay? Well, I think the first inequality, the most interesting and maybe very hard problem is to prove it for initial data with multiple black holes. I will say this is a hard problem, maybe also a deep problem, because this is connected with the uniqueness of the Kerr black hole for this connected horizon, and this is still an open problem. So it's not known if you can have many disconnected Kerr imbalance. Very recently, it has been proved that you cannot have two black holes which are in equilibrium balanced with the spin-spin repulsion. And remarkably enough, to prove that, Nogi, Bauer, and Henning, they use this inequality. But for many, this is still an open problem. And this inequality is also connected with that. So there are some interesting partial results by Krusel, Lee, and Weinstein. So let me also say that the key to prove this inequality, at the end what you are proving, is that the extreme Kerr is a minimum of all data with fixed angular momentum in axial symmetry. And also this minimum property, from my point of view, is very interesting because tell you something about the stability, I will say, in some sense, of the extreme Kerr. And now I'm trying to explode this condition to study the nonlinear stability or the linear stability of extreme Kerr under revolution. But I don't want to talk about that. And the second, we have some very nice numerical evidence that the inequality holds with Omar Ortiz, that the inequality holds for many black holes. The second open problem that I was trying to think before coming here is about higher dimensions. And I can imagine the situation as follows. So you, probably many of you know that for the generalization of Kerr in higher dimensions, this Meyer-Perry black hole, there is no extreme limit. So you can have ultra-spinning black hole. That means there is no relation between mass and angular momentum, at least for any choice of the parameters. So that means that the stationary solution that do not provide you any simple geometrical inequality, like in Kerr. On the other hand, the expectation is that dynamically, the solutions that have a lot of spin are unstable, but the ones that have lower angular momentum are stable. So what I will expect is the following, that probably you can do the following thing. You can prove, if you begin with low angular momentum, that the inequality is preserved in the dynamical regime using the same sort of technique, because you expect that the black hole is stable and then maybe it's a minimum of the energy of the mass. But probably you will see also that if you increase the angular momentum, then this minimum property you cannot prove any longer in the dynamical regime, and maybe you can see really this barrier, this instability in a rigorous way. Yeah? Well, this is something that I don't know, probably is would like to try. The second open problem is to say something about non-axially symmetric inequality between mass, between area and angular momentum. And of course, for that, you need a quasi-local definition of J. But maybe this inequality provides you some insight. So maybe the game will be, I try, but it's, I don't know, to try to find any definition of angular momentum that satisfies this kind of inequality, but they reduce to the Comar one in axial symmetry. Well, this seems to be hard. You know? And of course, this is not a well-defined mathematical problem because you don't have the definition. See? But I will really be happy if you can find some physical argument to say that the inequality should hold in the dynamical regime. I have no idea. And finally, this is probably the most important open question here to prove this one with angular momentum and area. This will be the generalization of Penrose inequality. And somehow this will sort of close the subject of geometrical, I will say, for black hole geometrical inequality in axial symmetry. Okay. So in the final minutes, let me say something about object. What do you mean by object? Well, something that is not a black hole. Let's say you have this glass. So and then you spin it. And then you ask yourself, is there any relation between the size of the glass and the angular momentum? Well, why? Well, I was inspired, of course, in this inequality. You can interpret this as the size of the black hole, and this is the angular momentum. And at the beginning, I thought maybe the relation is between area and angular momentum. And by area, you take the area of the boundary. So that maybe there is an universal inequality between the area of the boundary and the angular momentum. But this is not true. So area for a body is not a really good measure of size. So, but let's say you have some measure of size. What means by that? Let's say, for example, a trivial one will be enclose the body in a sphere and the radius of the minimal sphere that enclose the body, for example. Just let's say you have some measure. So I want to argue that there is an universal inequality of this form. This will be some characteristic radius of the body, and here I restore the fundamental constant, okay? So this constant, of course, these are the constants that appear in this inequality. Yeah? So this will be a square of radius, and if you put all the fundamental constant, will be g divided by c to the cube. And well, I can produce an heuristic argument. I don't want to go into the details. Just flash you what the rough idea is. And the idea is quite simple. Let's say you have a body like this one, and then you want to increase the angular momentum by fixing the size. So you are not allowed to make the body bigger. What can you do? You can do two things, I think. You can spin it faster, or you can put more matter inside. These are the two mechanisms to increase the angular momentum. But to the velocity, there is, of course, a limit, because at some point, the boundary of the body is going to spin at the speed of light. And if you put more and more matter, but fixing the size, by the Hoop conjecture, you are going to produce a black hole. But we know that in the black hole, the inequality holds. That means that, well, then there is sort of a limit of the two mechanisms, and you can be a bit more precise in this argument, but then you expect that perhaps there is sort of this general inequality for whole bodies in the universe. And by body, I mean just region, some region. What is a body? It's a region. Well, and I have some result. I will say this is a preliminary result, but I like it, in which you have a maximal axially symmetric region and with constant density. Now here I have matter with constant density. I can prove the following thing, which I have to define you what the radius is. So the angular momentum is clear, so you have a region with some matter of constant density. Because you have axial symmetry, you have a good definition of angular momentum. But the tricky part is how to define the radius. Well, I don't want to claim that this is an optimal definition of radius, but I think that this is an honest candidate. And this is based on a very, I would say, deep theorem by Sean and Yao, in which they construct a radius which looks complicated. It is complicated, but I claim that it's useful. Essentially, the radius is the following. How do you define the radius of a region? You try to inflate the biggest order that you can. And it's a radius of this order that you put. Well, my radius is not the same one as the Chon and Yao radius. You have to define by this formula. And the important thing is, of course, that with this radius, you can prove the inequality that I want to prove. And that this radius has sort of some nice property that if you put a sphere in flat space, give you the number you expect and so on. But again, I would like to see if there is better definition of size that can be applied to objects which have non-quantum density, of course. And this is something that we are working with Omar, doing some numerical experiment also. So these are some review articles if you want to learn more there. Thank you very much.
Classical work in Newtonian gravity, where for bodies in hydrostatic equilibrium, rotating bodies. I mean, there's a ton of work that was done to try to prove an inequality on the angular velocity of that.
But the C does not appear there.
I'm sorry.
The C, the constant C, that's not
exactly.
A,
so that's
I mean, you told me thing in Canada that time. I was checking this thing. And also, I discussed with Gary Gibb on these things. And well, I mean, I don't see a relation because there the C does not appear at all. I don't know. So I was trying to find any relationship, but I couldn't. Yeah. And that depends on the models. Here, my claim will be just assume only dominant energy condition. Try to prove things. This will be the game.
So if you turn this around as a condition on J, then J has to be smaller than a certain bound that scales like C cubed. So in the Newtonian limit, that bound would be infinite.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to suggest that it's not a very strong bound. I mean,
can be. Yeah, of course, this bound, like, exactly, for Newtonian things, seems to be trivial. But it's non-trivial for neutron star, for example, which, I mean, a neutron star, I mean, if you compute the numbers, it's the order of magnitude of 10 or 100. I mean, so for neutron star, it's the same order of magnitude. But I agree, in Newton, seems to be trivial. Exactly.
Doesn't you have an implicit role in the equation of space?
Yeah, I think the role The physical idea is that the velocity at the surface should not exceed the clearing velocity, because if you do that, then you start shedding mass.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you can't have hydrostatic equilibrium.
So would you say, if one were to prefer data that the violates the inequalities?
Which one?
Like the angular momentum, J less than E. So you have scenario that is dynamic, you have a crop surface.
Yeah.
And you put more J.
Yeah, so I mean, the issue, of course, is how to measure the J in the non-axial symmetric. So
I can see an axial picture. So a black hole with an accretion picture. So you put a lot of angular momentum in the accretion picture.
Well, the inequality, if the black hole, the outermost surface is stable always, and then the inequality should be satisfied. This is the theorem. So this is, I mean, if you have a black hole, let's say you have any initial data, okay, with accretion D whatsoever, and then you take the outermost apparent horizon. Okay? This is stable by definition, but it's like this. You calculate the area, you calculate the angular momentum, and this inequality should be satisfied. In axial symmetry, that's all. You cannot violate that.
See, then you can place a bound on what type of accretion it's depending on where it is, what's the mass.
How are you going to relate the accretion disk with the...
Yeah, I imagine there's some matter orbiting around the black hole.
Mm.
So I can then... It has to, in order to satisfy the theorem, right? So I can calculate what is the area of the apparent horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And I can calculate what is the total J. So I can only go so far.
Mm-hmm.
So then either I'm placing a bound on the mass of the disk.
Yeah.
to define J and non X is
one? Well, I mean, this definition of there are many suggestions. There are many of using the old ones are were using these Nested-Witten's type of things, you know. And then in this new definition by Yao and Wang, they have some proposals. But I mean, well, it's complicated. It's complicated to implement, you know. So I don't know. I really don't know.
I mean, there are the, if you don't mind doing a global definition, there are these things, London, et cetera, that have generalized the positive energy theorems. They give you an M and J back.
What do you mean by that?
They basically say that M is greater than or equal to J.
With the positive mass theorem, what?
Yeah, you basically use the Witten method.
No. This is
so
important.
No.
Yeah, this is important.
And
this is
give you a local.
No. Look. This is important. With the Witten type of argument, you can prove that M is bigger than Q, okay? But you cannot prove this one. With the Witten type, you cannot.
There's a result which is claimed.
No, but it's wrong. I know.
From the origin, how you hook an origin to measure the angular momentum will become completely change the J.
No, you just define the things in the usual way.
What's the usual way? You need an axis with respect to which you're going to measure angular
momentum. No, so these results I'm talking about don't
which
make
is, a paper by Zhang, you mean, or what?
I'm sorry?
A paper by Zhang, the name of the author, Zhang, a Chinese. Zhang, no.
No, I don't know this
okay.
one. No, but the one by London is the one that's the best record.
Okay, no, but I mean, this is, I'm completely sure that, I mean, many people try to prove that, but there is one key issue, for example, in all these spinor arguments, first, they never use axial symmetry, and second, the dimension play no role. And I certainly this is true in dimension four, but it's false in higher dimensions. And spinor is completely insensitive to this higher dimension.
I know this partially because I was one of the people that found a five-dimensional solution with matter which violated
this.
I think it's okay. Certain people suggest that it's not been that old. It's not good at all.
So about this K less area thing, I know some Calvin people, the numerical relativists, Machio and Jeffrey Lawrence, they were doing this near extreme merger studies, and they were looking at they have some like they define some quantity J, which is not, I mean, this quantity phi is not a Keeling vector, but they sort of use that to define a cosmic J on the horizon, and they divide this J by the area of the horizon, and what they see is that thing is like can be infinitely close to one, but always smaller than one, something like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I didn't know. Well, I mean, I know, but this is a numerical experiment. Yes, I know. Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I know. Yeah. So that's somehow they. So, but you know, these definitions are never unique because these are approximate things, and so. But yeah, no, I mean, I check all these numerical experiments, and all of them seem to. But okay, so we have to have a nice, good definition of angular momentum.
So one last question here. So what happens if you don't have two asymptotic ends? Like imagine I'm considering data that will collapse for a black hole, but I don't have two asymptotic ends. I only have one. So you cannot say anything in that case?
No. I mean, let's say if you have. So the theorem. So I prove the theorem. This one. Okay. So maybe the ideal version of the theorem will be, for example, that you have two apparent horizons here. Here you have the matter all inside with one end. And then you can prove the same inequality.
No, but here you're not talking about horizons.
No. But they are hidden. Why? Because if you don't have any hole, the angular momentum is zero. So the initial data should have some hole at some point, because otherwise the Coleman integral will give you zero. And the theorem will be trivial, will be positive mass. So you have to have some hole. Either the topology is non-trivial, which I choose this case because it was easy from the point of view of the mathematics, or you put some matter here. So here the angular momentum is non-trivial because you have the matter here. And then you can, but this is, I don't know how to prove this one. The angular momentum is conserved in vacuum. That means that this surface integral should be the same as this one, but there you cannot go inside the matter region because, I mean.
Right, okay.
So this is a non-trivial situation in which you describe a collision, for example, and I expect the theorem to hold here. Well, but I don't know how to prove it. I mean, in one situation, if you have this situation, maybe there is a trick in which you can reduce this one to this one, just gluing something in the other side. But this one is.
I mean, let's say you do that. I consider the other case where that one.
This one.
Or the second one. Prior to that, had a case where you had, say, the starter was collapsing, and yet there is no parameterization. Later on, it's going to fall. But okay, if I can prove it from here up, it should have applied wrong. I mean, it should have been good also earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And this ties into your last comment about the non. You think there's a way to just...
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, the key issue with this size measure is how to define a size that somehow is a size for both object and black hole, and this one does not satisfy this property. It's too rough. You know. Yeah, you're right.
Okay, yes, thanks, Sir.